Don't pass gas. Take it outside. Get the facts at don'tpassgas.org. A message from the Ad Council and the American Legacy Foundation.
This is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa.
Taking care of business and working overtime.
With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. I'm Don Soa. Delighted to have you here with us on AM 790. This is the Money Talk program. Volatility all week long. I mean, I can't. It's been pretty amazing. Starting, though, off a brand new month here in 2018. But stocks did end mixed after a pretty volatile session as traders were starting to worry about the potential for rising interest rates. Now, granted, that's the sort of thing that has been built into the market, according to analysts. But, you know, day to day, it's like everybody's looking for a new excuse to do something. So when the market has had a nice run up, as it did in literally in the last 13 months or so, it's been pretty amazing. You know, they get to a point now where rather than simply saying, well, let's look for reasons to stay in the market and continue to advance higher. They are starting to look for reasons to take money off the table, I guess. And not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I've recommended to people who, you know, let's face it, who knows you better than you do, right? And if your psychology, if your emotions, if your ability to sleep at night is affected by the fact that you've made so darn much money in the last year or two, if that's been a problem for you, then maybe it would make some sense for your better night's sleep for you to actually take some money off the table. I would be reluctant to suggest to anyone that this would be the time to move to cash. I think that would not be a thoughtful thing. I think anybody who chose to go heavily into cash at this point would probably find at some point during the course of the year they discovered that they regretted that decision. But that doesn't mean it wouldn't hurt to have more cash than you have historically held. Now, let me explain what that means. When we look at managed portfolios, when I say managed, these are portfolios that individual investors typically have, or families or households. And they are managed, they are paying someone a fee to manage that money. And they are managed by a series of models that oftentimes the advisory firms will structure. And those models will be going through an ongoing evolution, shall we say. In other words, the management teams must keep their ear to the ground and see what's happening around them. They're making their decisions based upon the nature of the economy, the nature of the market, and very importantly, the nature of the client's unique needs. So there should not be any specific model that, or maybe two or three models that everybody gets plugged into, but instead you can use base models as benchmarks that client portfolios can be compared to on an ongoing basis. But there should be some elements of the client portfolio that are unique to that client. That doesn't mean that if you have a few hundred accounts or a few hundred clients that you might not have a few of them that are similar or the same. That typically could happen. I mean, even if you just look at it as a coincidence, but I would think that if you say a person's risk propensity puts them really in the conservative category or in the moderate category, especially in the conservative side. If you're in conservative model, I think that the effort that the advisor and money manager went through to look at the risk-reward profile of what is a conservative portfolio, and if they've satisfied themselves and the client that a particular mix of holdings, whether it's between stocks, bonds, alternatives, and other things, a certain mix is in fact appropriate to meet that, well, the qualifying nature based on risk and reward, the qualifying nature of the portfolio. It wouldn't be, I mean, that would mean that almost anyone that fell into that category of conservative investing would have not necessarily identical, but a very similar portfolio using similar holdings internally. And of course, if it works, then that's even more likely to be the case. But today the market bounced around quite a bit. The Dow was up about 37 points at the end of the day, rallying more than 150 points and swinging literally as much as 135 points lower during the course of the day. Now, the S&P 500 closed right around the flat line after rising perhaps as much as about 0.4% during the course of trading. NASDAQ shed about 0.35%. Now, earlier, the tech-heavy index had actually traded 0.4% higher. Companies like Facebook, their shares hit an all-time high. Facebook reported better-than-expected earnings and revenue, on Wednesday. We've sort of seen the bond market roll over, for most of 2018 so far. But we're seeing even more intense potential selling recently. And that's, of course, as there's a demand for selling of bonds, that means that the price of the bonds are going to come down. And when the price of bonds come down, then the yields will move higher. Today, we're seeing these types of bonds approach levels that we haven't really seen in a long time. So you're looking at very familiar categories like the 10-year bond, the U.S. 10-year Treasury. That yield rose to trade around 2.77%, while the 30-year bond yield topped about 3%. But you notice that the yield on a 10-year and a 30-year are pretty darn similar. Thursday marked the first day of the new month, so I don't know that this is going to be reflective of the entire month of February, but we'll have to wait and see. January was the best month for the S&P 500 and the Dow since March of 2016. The NASDAQ Composite had its biggest one-month gain since October of 2015. So the S&P 500 also notched its best January performance since 1997. Big numbers. Historically, strong January gains. So we talked about this on a previous Money Talk program. Strong gains in the month of January have led to pretty solid gains in the stock market, the equity markets, for the rest of the year. You've heard the old adage, as January goes, so goes the year. Well, we'll see if that rings true here in 2018. Stocks were under pressure early, though, today after the release of some weaker-than-expected productivity numbers. The U.S. government said in a preliminary report that the fourth quarter last year, fourth quarter productivity actually fell 0.1%. Economists that had been polled by Reuters were actually expecting a gain of 1%. So it ended up down about 1.1%, in terms of expectation. Not only did productivity for the fourth quarter miss consensus numbers, but it also fell below 0%, according to Jeremy Klein. He's with FNB Securities. He's the chief market strategist. And he sent out a note to investors. He said, a weak print theoretically portends to higher inflation. So you're always saying, well, what do these numbers actually mean? Well, when the productivity number drops below 0%, which is what happened for the fourth quarter, that could be an early sign. And we're saying that it's a potential sign of higher inflation coming in here during the year 2018. Now, higher inflation is something I've been looking for probably for 2 years. So I will ultimately be right. The question is, was my timing accurate? Probably not. In this particular analysis, Klein was also suggesting, he said that an alarming drop in German stocks had put further downward pressure on the U.S. market as well. You don't always think of that, but the DAX, which is the German exchange, it fell 1.4% today. The United Kingdom and the French markets, the CAC 40, as they call it, the CAC 40, also fell. The FTSE 100, which is British, Financial Times Index, it declined about 0.5%. As I said, the French indices, the CAC 40, was down about 0.4%. So Thursday marks probably the busiest day in the U.S. earnings season. Remember, we're still getting earnings numbers coming in for the fourth quarter of last year. About 70 companies reporting all in one day, and among them, Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Visa, and Mattel, among the companies actually scheduled in here in the after hours. AutoNation and Blackstone are among the companies that reported before the bell. Lindsay Bell, an investment strategist at CFRA, said that tech earnings will be key for the market to continue moving higher. About 51% of the tech sector has, in fact, reported. 86% of those companies have actually beaten expectations, so that's a good sign, which is better than the S&P 500's beat rate. And the S&P 500 is pretty impressive right now, above 75% on both top-line and bottom-line numbers. So Wall Street also looked ahead to the release of U.S. government monthly jobs numbers, and economists over at Reuters expect the economy to have added about 180,000 jobs. Hey, folks, you're listening to the Money Talk program. I'm Don Soa. Hey, I've been with you all week. It's been great. I appreciate you allowing me into your car during your drive time all week long. Tomorrow, so Friday, Steve Beauvais will be back with us from vacation at 5 o'clock. So I wonder what Steve will have to say and what his perspective on what's happening in the world around us from far away. Imagine, what does the stock market and the economy look like when you're out on a fishing boat in the Gulf of Mexico? Well, we'll find out. I'm Don. I'll be right back.
Sponsored by Tax Doctor. Owe the IRS $10,000 or more? Call the Tax Doctor to settle tax debt for less. 800-542-9112. 800-542-9112.
Gets it to Okolie. Oak, two on the shot clock. He's going to have to fire it inside.
The three!
Count it.
This is Mike Martin, Brown Bears men's basketball coach in class of 2004. I would like to invite you all to the Pizzatola Center this season to see our exciting young team compete against our Ivy League rivals. Join us as we take on Columbia Saturday, February 10th at 6 p.m.
Hunsaker, shot at the buzzer! Yeah! Bears win it!
Brown vs. Columbia presented by Mohegan Sun. Visit brownbears.com for game and ticket information.
Your credit card companies love you. They love it when your cards stay maxed out. They love it when you only make minimum payments. They love it when you struggle. Why? Because they own you. And minimum payments mean maximum profits. Here's great news. National Debt Relief is now offering you free information on how to escape your credit card debt nightmare. If you owe more than $10,000 in credit card debt and are only barely making minimum payments, know this. You may not have to pay it all back. In fact, you may have the right to settle that debt for only a fraction of what you owe. National Debt Relief has helped thousands of people get rid of over $500 million of debt, and they're A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau. Get the information you need for free right now before this offer goes away. Call National Debt Relief now and escape your credit card debt troubles. 800-379-9477. 800-379-9477. 800-379-9477.
I knew I was stuck at this kid's house for the night. I decided to just go to sleep and get the night over with. But those guys came into the bedroom and got into a massive pillow fight. Let me tell you, it's not easy falling asleep when a sweaty little kid falls on you every 5 seconds. Even after the light went out, Raleigh and his friends stayed up. A bunch of them snuck up on me to try and pull the hand in a bowl of warm water trick. Well, that was enough for me. I went downstairs to sleep in the basement even though it was pitch black. I left my sleeping bag upstairs and that was a mistake because it was freezing. I think it was probably the longest night of my life. When the sun came up this morning, I found out the reason it was so cold. I was sleeping right by the sliding glass door, and some fool had gone and left it open overnight. That really stunk, because if I knew there was a way to escape last night, I definitely would have taken it. To read more about the sleepover, check out Diary of a Wimpy Kid, The Last Straw by Jeff Kinney. Explore new worlds and check out more cool books at your local library, and visit read.gov, brought to you by the Library of Congress and the Ad Council.
People make your business work, but how do you find the right talent? ZipRecruiter. One click, post your job to over 100 top job boards. Then, smart matching technology instantly alerts quality candidates about your job. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
To try ZipRecruiter for free, just go to ZipRecruiter.com/talk. That's ZipRecruiter.com/talk.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And I would like to welcome you back to the Money Talk program, everybody. I'm Don Sowa. Delighted to have you sharing your drive with me here on AM 790. Now, if you've got a question for me, Maya's here. She's taking calls, and she will take your question. If you're driving and obviously not in a safe place to chat, just give her your question quickly. She'll plug it into my screen, and I will try to answer it before you reach your destination. The local number is 437-5000, and the toll-free number is 888-345-0790. That's 888-345-0790. A couple of things come out. I mean, we always look at the nature of changing the changing nature of business. And when we look at government making changes, whether it's deregulating, you know, eliminating regulations that had been there before, or just changing the basic rules, the way things are taxed or tipped or how things are handled, I often wonder, we're always looking to see, who really benefits from these changing rules, especially in the world of, especially the service sector. It's a tough one because you got a lot of people working in the service sector, whether that's hotels or restaurants and lots of other places of the sort, where quite frankly, rules related to things like the minimum wage, those rules become really, really important because you've got a lot of people in the service sector who are receiving minimum wage. Hopefully, if they're in a service like the restaurant type sector, they have the ability to take that maybe $7.50 or so an hour, which is sort of a national average, take that and actually increase it because they get tips. But what happens when all of a sudden, now usually I always thought that tip, now, and I admittedly all through high school and college, I worked in restaurants. So working, although in the back, I started out as a dishwasher like a great many young people, worked my way up as a prep cook, and then I worked what we called the board, which is basically where the meals are prepped, the short order cook at the grill because I was working in what essentially is a steakhouse. So, but watching staffers, watching a small army of floor staffers, the waitresses and the waiters, you know, you get a sense for people who, especially people like myself, I was a student in high school. It's one thing in college also, but there were a lot of people working in that restaurant who were more senior than I was. I was in my teens and early 20s, and many of these people had families of their own, and they're trying to eke out a living wage. And I think changing rules about minimum wage and tips and all this other stuff, you know, are the things that the student can probably handle. The young person who's not dependent upon their year-end paycheck, weekend paycheck to pay the rent, pay their food, pay the car payments, all the other stuff. Although, in fairness, I do know some people, especially in college, who pay all those things as well as trying to pay their tuition and room and board at school. But regardless of that, I'm a little more sensitive to the people who are trying to make a living and support a family from these types of service jobs. Now, I always believed, and you know, I've always been a person who was, I've always figured, be a strong tipper, leave 20%, as I typically do. I try to, because I know how hard these folks work. And I'm especially happy to do so when the person is particularly friendly and pleasant and thoughtful and efficient, bringing food on and being courteous you like pleasant people that are pleasant to be around. It raises your day. And if it's lunch, for example, you know, you might be having a tough day at the office, but you know, just all of a sudden a little bit of pleasantry for 45 or 50 minutes or whatever amount of time you have, you know, dealing with somebody who's pleasant, that can change your day. So I think that's the person is worthy of the tip, but I've always viewed the tip as part of their pay, but it's also a reward for the service I'm getting. I don't view it as me dealing as my obligation to assist the owner of the restaurant in compensating or paying their employees. I believe it's, and I certainly doesn't, is not something that I believe the employer should receive. But when Americans leave a tip at the table, you know, they expect that it will end up in the hands of the waiter, the waitress, or perhaps the busing staff. I doubt there's very few people that would honestly believe if you told them, or they'd be frustrated if you told them, that actually that tip is going to the owner of the restaurant. But that's exactly perhaps what a new rule that's been proposed by the Department of Labor may result in. The new rule is essentially designed to allow the tips to be pooled and shared among workers, I think. Now, that's a little different than the analogy I just gave you the point I made a minute ago. Wait staff at a restaurant could actually share a percentage of their tips with, you know, the busing staff that works with them to help them at the point of service. You go to a number of restaurants where there's two or three people out on the floor that are part of the service that you receive. There may be also some help going on with people who are washing the dishes and maybe even in some cases the chefs inside, the cook staff. Although I personally believe that the prep cooks, whoever in there actually preparing the meals, their salaries should reflect the work that they're doing specifically. But you know, I guess ultimately sometimes the tipping thing helps to redress some of the pay inequities that may hurt the broader, you know, industry and restaurant industry. But there's a hidden catch in the new rule, apparently. Restaurant owners, under the new rule, could be allowed to actually keep the tips for themselves as long as they pay workers the federal minimum wage of 7.25. Now, some tipped workers receive a much lower hourly wage than the 7.25, in some cases just over $2 an hour in some states, and they would not fall under the proposal, apparently. So if a person is receiving an amount as a waiter below the minimum wage of $7.25, and I'm talking about much further below, maybe even half of that, then they should receive the full tip and not have to share, not to give any of that to the owner of the restaurant. Now, a minimum wage, however, let's face it, $7.25 an hour, that is not a living wage in the United States. I think there's very few states in the country where earning that kind of money would actually help you raise a family and pay your bills. And most tipped workers depend on gratuities like the tips to cover the cost of their real genuine cost of living. Now, if their bosses are given the ability to actually siphon off a share of their tips for their own profitability, if they're able to do that, I think many of them, not all, but many of them will. The Bloomberg company, the Bloomberg Law, is reporting that a study that's attempting to estimate the impact of this rule on workers has actually been quashed by the Labor Department. I thought the Labor Department was there to provide for equity and avoid inequity within, you know, for the benefit of the workers. But the study suggested that billions of dollars in tips would be diverted to owners' pockets, and the Labor Secretary, Alex Acosta, their staff ultimately decided not to release to the public this reality while the rule is in what they call the comment period. It's still in the comment period. Now, the Economic Policy Institute, which is a left-leaning think tank, has released its own study of this particular issue, which suggests that $5.8 billion in tips would be taken from workers by owners each year under this new rule, potentially a little more than 16% of all annual gratuities. Now, I think that, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that number is a very ultra left wing. That's got to reflect assuming that all tips must be, you know, would be paid to the owners in general, as opposed to, as opposed to some part of it. Many restaurants are already facing challenges paying their employees now. Some are ending gratuities entirely, not paying tips, and switching to a standard service fee to be paid to servers and kitchen staff alike. This rule is framed in as a way to make it easier for restaurants to adopt flexible payment mechanisms for their workers. But in a typically Trump administration twist, I guess, it will likely provide an avenue for their compensation to be cut significantly. So we're looking into that. Now, the National Restaurant Association, which is a trade group, has been a key organization pushing for this new rule. I guess they represent the owners, not the workers, which will allow the members to capture a larger chunk of the money coming into their business. Critics of the proposal, including the last administration, the Obama administration, say that the Acosta's decision to hide the economic analysis is intended to make it easier for him to authorize the new rule maybe next year or later this year. The one silver lining for the service industry or for the servers themselves in withholding its analysis, the department may have violated procedures around how rules are made, providing some ammunition to the inevitable lawsuits that you know are coming and are going to be challenging them, whatever the final decision is. So we'll have to wait and see. Maybe this is an issue that's a little bit closer to my heart, having spent at least 7 years in the restaurant industry myself while I was a student. But, we think that people work in restaurants that serve us day in, day out. You know, they work really, really hard. And I think that they should, be able to earn their keep and earn a fair amount if the ownership is going to be, quite frankly, taking a chunk or all of the tips. I think that they should make sure that the wage that they're receiving is nowhere close to $7.25, but maybe $15, or closer to double the national minimum wage. Look, I'm going to take a quick break here on the Money Talk program. Gene and Mass, caller, will go to the lines very, very shortly, right when we come back from this brief break.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
Start the fun. Start the excitement. It's the Northeast International Auto Show
at the Rhode Island Convention Center, Friday, February 9th through the 11th.
Start your imagination.
Check out over 250 of the hottest new cars, new trucks, and SUVs.
Come see the ultra-exotic car collection,
courtesy of the Audrain Automobile Museum. These are some of the coolest cars on the planet. See pre-production models.
And it's all displayed in a non-selling environment.
You can even test drive vehicles from Toyota, Chrysler, Dodge, Fiat, Jeep, and Ram truck. And every day is Family Day. All kids 12 and under get in free. Every attendee gets a free 12-month subscription to Motor Trend.
The Northeast International Auto Show is where the excitement starts.
The 9th through the 11th at the Rhode Island Convention Center. Go to ProvidenceAutoShow.com for discounts. This auto show is presented by the Rhode Island Automobile Dealers Association and is produced by Motor Trend, so you know it's going to be good. Come for the cars, stay for the fun.
Winter is the perfect time to have tree work done at your home or business, so call the experts at Tree Solutions by Seascape at 800-294-5296. With leaves off the trees, their licensed and trained professional arborists can work more cost-effectively to get the job done. Plus, call Tree Solutions by Seascape now. You'll save 10% on any winter tree work. That includes tree removal, trimming, stump grinding, pruning, brush clearing, and deer repellent. The best lawn guys are the best tree guys. Tree Solutions by Seascape. Frozen ground means less vehicle damage to your lawn and less damage to the annual and perennial trees that are dormant this time of year. Winter is here, so take care of those dangerous trees before the snow or ice does it for you, causing damage to your home or property. Tree Solutions by Seascape has the latest equipment available so they can get to the hard-to-reach places that typical bucket trucks can't. Call Tree Solutions by Seascape now and save 10% on winter tree work. 800-294-5296, seascapeinc.com.
An important message from Medicare.
Hi, Sarah. I just spoke with Pamela. Did you know the health care law gives us new Medicare preventive benefits? Like a yearly wellness visit.
Well,
It's our chance to talk with our doctor about our care.
That's what I would.
Medicare also covers recommended cancer and preventive screenings.
Actually, I was the one who told Pamela.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
Learn more at Medicare.gov or call 1-800-MEDICARE. And tell your friends and family. Share the news. Share the health.
This is Money Talk with Dawn Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
And we're back with the second half of tonight's Money Talk program. I mentioned earlier on we are taking calls at 437-5000. That's the local number. And toll-free at 888-345-0790. It doesn't have to deal specifically with what we're talking about on the show. I'll give you a little bit of an update as to what's been happening in the market lately. But actually things that matter to you in the financial decisions you're trying to make. So let's head on out to Gene in Mass. Hey, Gene.
Hi, how are you?
Very good. What can I do for you?
Right. I have two questions. One is about my whole life insurance. My husband is on it, too. We do have cash surrender value in that whole life insurance.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if it would be best to take the money out from the cash surrender value, as I was told by the company that this cash surrender value is not going to be added to the death benefit.
They told you that the cash surrender value is not going to be added to the death benefit?
Yes.
So what happens to the life insurance policy when you take the cash out?
So when I take the cash out, it would be the death benefits will be reduced.
Yeah, and you're going to probably have to keep some cash in there, Gene. In other words, what is supporting the death benefit, which is the primary risk to the insurance company, are two things. Well, three things. One is the premiums that you're paying on an ongoing basis, which you still pay now, right?
Correct.
And the cash value that is built up in the plan over time.
Correct.
And, of course, the metrics of what's happening in the insurance world right now. In other words, the efficiency of the insurance company will also have something to do with what the cost of the life insurance is. So the question I would have for you is, they'll run what they call an in-force ledger for you.
Okay.
In other words, you tell them how much cash you'd like to pull out, and they will tell you, based upon the amount you're leaving in and the premiums that you're paying in this type of a policy, which is, this is not whole life. This is more of an adjustable life or universal life type insurance.
Correct. But then they actually classify it as whole life.
It really isn't, because if you were to, whole life is the most expensive insurance coverage that you could get. But typically, once you start pulling, most whole life plans, which are pure whole life, will not allow you to pull money out without typically surrendering the insurance coverage. A universal life or adjustable life policy, which is the more common case where you have some flexibility. See, they call it adjustable life for the reason, or universal life, because you can adjust the death benefit based upon the amount of financial support that exists inside the policy, the financial support being the premiums you're paying and how much cash you have in the plan. So if you reduce the cash that's in there because you're pulling some money out or you're taking out a loan or whatever way they recommend you do it, but if you pull some money out, what's the death benefit right now on the plan?
This is just the supplement to my term life insurance. So I got this when I was employed by one of the employer. And it allowed me to carry on with the plan.
Okay, but what I mean is, if you're the insured, if you passed away, how much would your beneficiary receive?
It would be about $100,000.
Okay, so when they run the in-force ledger for you, that will tell you, based upon the amount of cash that you leave in the plan and the amount that you're paying in the current premiums, they will tell you how much death benefit you'll actually have, because there will not be enough cash in there supplementing your premiums to continue to provide a $100,000 death benefit to you. But like I said, that may or may not be a problem for you. I guess in the end, it depends on how much you need the life insurance. I mean, how much cash are you talking about?
I believe it's about close to $8,000 for me, and under my spouse is about 3 to 4.
Well, how much of the cash were you looking to pull out?
Not really sure.
I think you were probably hoping to take all of it out, weren't you?
Was thinking of it, but then because I heard that if I don't take the money out, it's not going to pay out if something happened to me.
Well, see, that's a bit of a confusing. The term they use is a misnomer. What I mean by that is that it's a confusing piece of information. The truth of the matter is, yes, you're not going to receive, it depends on the type of product, but you're not going to receive let's say there was $8,000 of cash value in your plan. The person dies, the beneficiary doesn't receive $108,000. But the death benefit itself, the $100,000 on you over your lifetime for as long as you're going to keep the insurance in place, that's being supported by the cash that is building in there. And by the premiums you're paying. So if you're reducing the cash that's in there, then the amount of insurance that they would pay in the event of your death to your beneficiary would have to be reduced substantially. So again, they can do this for you, though, Gene. They can actually go in and they can run the analysis. And you could say, if I pull out this amount of money from my cash value, if I pull out this amount, please run for me a ledger that tells me how much death benefit would I have in the plan so long, and I understand that I'd have to continue to pay the premiums.
Right.
So if you're paying a monthly premium of $50 a month or whatever amount it happens to be, if you say, if I continue to make that payment, how much life insurance would I have on me in the event of my death? Don't be shocked how old are you now?
49.
Don't be shocked if they turn around and say, okay, if in the event of your death, if you take the $8,000 or whatever amount they allow you to take out in cash, don't be shocked if they say the amount that you'd receive in the event of your death is $27,000.
Wow.
Now, it's going to cut the death benefit substantially because I don't know how long you've owned the policy, but my guess is if it's a small amount of premiums going into the plan and you've owned it for a while, it doesn't build that much cash value over time. And if you pull the cash that's in there already, that cash reflects a lot of different things. It's dividends that have been paid. It's the efficiency of the insurance company itself and the new money you're paying in. Over the first many years that you put money into the plan, there's very little cash value building up. It's in subsequent later years that the cash starts to build up. So don't think of the life insurance really as a very good investment or savings vehicle. Think of it more as a fairly, at this stage of the game, you may not be paying a lot in premiums. And the reason that the premiums are not high is probably because you've got some cash value in there. So if you take the cash out, don't be shocked that the ledger they print out for you, and they'll do this for you, the ledger will indicate that the amount of death benefit coverage you have in the event of your death is going to be pretty low.
I believe I asked that question before, And I think it's if, let's say, I took the money out from the cash surrender value, the death benefit would be somewhere in the 90s.
Well, remember, cash surrender value is what would you receive from the company if you, in fact, surrender the insurance policy?
Oh, I see.
So that's what cash surrender means. Right now, there is some cash value in it if it's a cash value contract. If you reduce, I don't believe for a second, this is just my opinion, I started out over 35 years ago in the financial services field in the insurance side of the business, and I'm telling you, based on what I've learned, I'd be shocked if there was $90,000 of death benefit if you pulled all the cash out.
Okay.
But again, I'd want to see it in print. They could produce a ledger, what they call an in-force ledger for you, that will actually show you what exactly would happen. What would the death benefit look like? And for how long? I mean, is it possible that it would drop over time, the death benefit, or is it going to be fixed for the rest of your life? See, whole life means the death benefit is secure up to your age 100 based on the premiums you're paying and, of course, the assumption that there will be cash value building. The time I think about surrendering and taking the cash value on a whole life policy, and I've seen this over the years, is when all of a sudden, for whatever reason, if the cash value is either approaching or greater than the death benefit.
I see.
But most modern policies sold over the last 20 or 30 years don't have that type of a feature. I know my father, who is in his 90s, he had a whole bunch of these little small whole life policies, $5,000 and $6,000 death benefit, but they didn't build the death benefit. The cash built up. I saw a couple. I said, "Geez, Dad, you know, you get a death benefit of $7,000 here, but the cash value on the thing is $8,000."
Yeah.
I wouldn't have to tell you, Gene, that it's the time to cash that out, would I?
Right.
You know that the death benefit's not greater than the cash value, and you could probably use the cash.
Right. That's right.
All right. Do you have any other any questions for me other than that?
One quick one. So this insurance that I'm paying, it's going to pay for indefinitely. Is that true like that?
If you keep paying the premiums based upon the numbers you have, if it's whole life, paying those premiums and allowing the cash value to build normally, that would probably, if it is whole life, then that's intended. In other words, it was originally priced to ensure that the death benefit would be honored by the company right out to your age 100, which is the actual definition of whole life.
I see.
If I read the policy and it said something different than that, then I might have a different answer. But based on what you've told me, that's what I would suggest.
Okay.
Okay.
And the other question is about, if we still have time, it's about the Roth IRA that my husband and I have. So we bought this small Roth IRA, and the brokers has change hands so many times, and to the point that I feel like I want to take the money out and put it somewhere else.
How much money do you have in the Roths right now, Jean?
It's very small. It's just total of them would be about 8 to 10,000.
You know what you could do? You could either contact, actually, there's an office right downtown in Providence, Fidelity.
Okay.
Or you could go online and get the and call the 800 number for Vanguard. These are just two great companies that have Roth IRAs. There's plenty of other ones. But these are the ones that specialize in working directly with the consumer.
Okay.
You can establish Roth IRAs with them, and they will help, even right online, help you fill out a transfer authorization, which will allow you to transfer your existing Roths into a new Roth with them.
Okay.
And they are, especially the Vanguard plan, is very low cost. And I believe you need like a minimum of $3,000 to open it.
Okay.
So that may be perfect for you. And they have really nice, very inexpensive index funds like the S&P 500 fund and others, or the total market index. That would do a great job for you, at least with that part of the money. Make sure the money's growing for you, even if it's 7 or 8%. But the internal costs are low, and you don't have to worry about whether they're going to go out of business or not. These guys will always be there, probably for the most part.
How about the expense ratio on that?
Expense ratios with Vanguard are like 0.25 or less.
Okay.
That's as low as it goes. I mean, that's pretty good stuff. And by the way, all the funds that they're using are no load, so there's no front-end charge.
That's nice.
All right, Gene.
All right. Thank you so much.
Listen, good luck with the insurance issue.
Thank you.
But I would ask the question and have them send it to you in writing so you really know.
Ledger. Yes, definitely.
All righty. Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Money Talk program. I'm Don Sowa. I'm going to take another quick break here on the program. We'll have a little bit of time left after that, and we'll be back with more Money Talk right here on AM 790. So please stick around.
I need a new heating system. Where do I start?
R.I. Pipe Guys.
Our water heater is on the fritz.
R.I. Pipe Guys.
We want to convert from oil to natural gas.
R.I. Pipe Guys.
What about...
R.I. Pipe Guys is the place to start for all your heating, cooling, and plumbing needs. From installing a new heating system or an ice-cold AC unit, R.I. Pipe Guys are your guys and offer superior service and quality. Everybody's got a guy, but R.I. Pipe Guys are the guys. 401-603-4016 or visit ripipeguys.com for details. Details, rebates, and special offers.
Mom? Dad?
What is it, honey?
Well, you know that Melissa's transferring to a charter school and...
Slow down, Katie.
Private schools are just...
Fact. All charter schools are public schools.
Katie, we just don't have the money to send you...
Fact. Charter schools are tuition-free.
And Melissa said that the kids in this school are really motivated to...
Fact. Charter schools are boosting student achievement.
So can I enroll, please?
The National Alliance for Public Charter Schools wants you to know the facts. Visit www.publiccharters.org.
Your credit card companies love you. They love it when your cards stay maxed out. They love it when you only make minimum payments. They love it when you struggle. Why? Because they own you. And minimum payments mean maximum profits. Here's great news. National Debt Relief is now offering you free information on how to escape your credit card debt nightmare. If you owe more than $10,000 in credit card debt and are only barely making minimum payments, know this. You may not have to pay it all back. In fact, you may have the right to settle that debt for only a fraction of what you owe. National Debt Relief has helped thousands of people get rid of over $500 million of debt, and they're A-plus rated by the Better Business Bureau. Get the information you need for free right now before this offer goes away. Call National Debt Relief now and escape your credit card debt troubles. 800-379-9477. 800-379-9477. 800-379-9477.
Can you tell if the surfaces in this kitchen are crawling with bacteria that could cause chronic arthritis? Listen. You can't see it either. Wash surfaces, utensils, and hands with soapy water while preparing food, especially when handling raw meats or eggs. Raw food may contain bacteria that can make you very sick or worse. Roughly 3,000 Americans will die from food poisoning this year, but you can keep your family safer. Check your steps at foodsafety.gov. Brought to you by the USDA, HHS, and the Ad Council.
This is Money Talk with Don Sowa, exclusively on AM 790 Talk and Business.
We're back with the last segment of tonight's show. You know, I was reading an article earlier today. It really caught my attention. It was this online part of the website MarketWatch. The writer's a gentleman named Howard Gold, who's probably been in the financial media business for a very, very long time. But it caught my attention because he was saying basically that investors are way too greedy for a stock market sell-off to actually take hold. That's an interesting perspective, saying why does he believe the market's going to continue moving higher over the next couple of years? Well, when stocks fell 2% over Monday and Tuesday, a great many of the so-called online experts or on radio and TV were very quick to give their explanations. Things like, let's say Amazon and Berkshire Hathaway and J.P. Morgan Chase were banding together to upend the whole healthcare market. Well, that may be part of it. Or how about, the 10-year Treasury notes yield crept above 2.7%? Or how about the strong global economy and the weak U.S. dollar would push inflation higher, forcing the Federal Reserve to raise short-term interest rates faster than we expected? These are all disasters du jour, right? But as in this case here, as Howard Gold learned years ago, there's no reason for any short-term market move to occur, or no reason you can predict anyway, and any number of reasons that a short-term market move can occur. Indeed, by midday on Wednesday of this week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average had actually recovered a healthy slice of what it had lost, and the S&P showed some modest gains. So Gold was telling some, looking back at his own history, Howard, he's saying that he was doing a summer internship at Reuters Wall Street Bureau at one time, where he was knocking out four market updates an hour. So every 15 minutes he had to, you know, type in a market update. In each one, he had to actually tell readers why the market was moving either up or down or sideways or whatever direction. Now, he's not complaining about Reuters, their great organization, but just the nature of the beast. He said that it wasn't his finest hour, but he said that he scrambled to get someone, anyone on the phone, who could actually tell him from moment to moment why stocks were actually doing what they were doing. And as the day wore on, he would notice sort of an echo chamber effect was being created in which sources were actually starting to repeat things that he had written earlier in the day. So maybe they were getting their information from his articles. Oh, boy. So he decided that the markets are often driven by traders' whims and impulses with no real reasoning behind it sometimes. Without knowing it, he had embraced what we call behavioral finance. That's where he turned, probably late last week, he was thinking about this concept of behavioral finance. Before the sell-off occurred earlier in the week for a reading, he turned for a reading of the market's mood, specifically its level of greed. And he interviewed the man who had actually literally written the book on the subject, Beyond Greed and Fear. He's a behavioral economist named Hirsch Sheffrin from Santa Clara University. Now, Professor Sheffrin wrote that in the aggregate, we were seeing much more greed today than fear, sort of a huge pendulum shift from early part of the decade when investors were still sort of traumatized by the financial crisis of 07 and 08. Now, we've been moving towards the greed side of the spectrum since right around 2013, he suggests, and that was picked up. That has actually picked up some steam since early 2016, and then after, of course, the most recent presidential elections, which he linked to an acceleration in earnings greed, by the way. So his take was that the Trump bull market, like the Trump economy, is the culmination of trends that have actually been developing for years, going back to probably 2009 and 2010. Greed and fear, according to Professor Sheffrin, explained, are rooted in neurobiology or brain chemistry. Fear and anxiety come from, well, amygdala. Amygdala is one of the brain's most ancient structures. Greed is linked to the nucleus accumbens, A-C-C-U-M-B-E-N's, accumbens. That's where neurotransmitters, dopamine, exist, which actually promotes desire, and serotonin, which enhances satiarian inhibitions and operate, according to the folks over at McGill University. Now, in the market sense, we've come to associate greed to mean not so much waiting, you know, wanting more than your fair share. So they're not talking about greed as being bad here, but simply the desire for more in setting perhaps some high goals for your returns, according to the professor. Now, it's not just getting the reward. It's also anticipating the reward. It's all part of the neuropsychology. And it really drives a lot of your behavior. As stocks rise, doubts and inhibitions fade. As our goals are met, we feel more and more, we're emotionally rewarded. And we begin wanting and expecting higher returns as a result of it. We start to think in a straight line. The market is going up, and we believe that it has every reason to continue going higher. Rising markets, especially those like this one that we've been in, that's, you know, markets that rarely correct, a 10% decline, in other words, they induce sort of a complacency, and you start to develop a lower aversion to risk. In other words, you have higher risk tolerance. Bull market euphoria really is a natural high. But that has a downside to it, of course. We become vulnerable to reckless behavior, taking unnecessary and imprudent risks, according to Sheffrin. Bitcoin's a good example of that, and even more exotic cryptocurrencies as well, which brings us back to today's stock market. CNN Money's Fear and Greed Index comprises seven indicators, including the spread between stock and bond returns, new highs versus new lows, advancing versus declining volumes on the New York Stock Exchange. They look at market momentum, and they also look at put and call options. As of last week, that index stood at 78 on a scale of 100, or a very high level of greed, extreme greed territory, if you're above 75, I guess. I think that's a pretty accurate characterization of overall market sentiment, according to Sheffrin, the professor. And he said that he'd say that the markets are probably about 20% overvalued based upon fundamentals that he's comfortable with. Now, maybe everyone would not use those same numbers, but that's what this person says. After the sell-off that occurred a while back, the Fear and Greed Index fell back to 62, which is, you know, greed, but simply mere greed, thanks largely to a spike in one indicator, which is the CBOE VIX, the Volatility Index. By midday on Wednesday, the VIX had slipped a bit as stocks rebounded. Now, will the reflex rally that we've seen last? Who knows? We had an up day overall today, despite interday volatility. Now, only a sustained correction of some sort, which is probably by some standards considered by many to be overdue, some sort of a market pullback, you know, only that will disabuse many investors of the notion that stocks can only go one way, which is up. We don't want anybody to believe that. The market goes up and the market goes down. The market goes up and the market goes down. After the market goes up, it usually goes down. In other words, it doesn't go straight up all the time. Now, if stocks go, you know, off to the races again tomorrow, then extreme greed will be back in the saddle again. But again, the other side of this is believed too, which is also incorrect and negative from a perspective of emotional management. When the market starts going down, there are some people that get so freaked out, again, an emotional reaction. On the other side, fear starts to overtake all of the elements within your brain that deal with greed. And you start to believe that the market, again, can only move in a straight line, but in this case, can only go down, which is just as untrue as the premise that the market can only go up. We talk an awful lot about behavioral finance, behavioral investing, and the psychology of ups and downs in these markets. We just let you know that ultimately good and successful investing is a function of analysis of your life, your needs, over time. Time will give you the opportunities you need. There's no guarantees about direction. There's no guarantees what will trigger the next major market move. But I can promise you that after the market has gone up for a while, there will come some point where it pulls back. It will come down. And that's probably a good thing. The real question will be, if you're a successful investor over time, and time will give you the luxury of behaving properly. But if you're a successful investor, it'll be because you can manage your emotions, you can manage your behavior, and you can understand that the market does move in both directions. And the good news is, at least if you look at history, the market does tend to go up more often than it goes down. Folks, you've been listening to the Money Talk program tonight. Thanks for joining me all week long. And again, hey, tune in tomorrow. Steve Bovee will be back from vacation. I'd like, maybe he'll share with you some of his stories from the week, the big fish stories. And believe me, Steve's one of the few guys that can brag about the size of the fish he catches and be telling you the truth. I've seen the pictures. Hey, folks, in the meantime, you have a good evening. Good night.
I'm Jay Farner from Quicken Loans. The rate today on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 4.125%, APR 4.36%. But choosing the right mortgage lender means